Part 3, Fall of Babylon. We're going to be looking at the end of chapter 18 of Revelation and the first 5 verses of chapter 19. So just a brief review here. In part 1, which began in chapter 18, the first part of chapter 18, was the description and the rationale for Babylon's fall. It described a utter destruction and desertion. Basically, it brought in Old Testament imagery of cities that had been abandoned and destroyed and abandoned, where wild animals roam, that there's empty. Why did Babylon fall? Because she gave nations, kings, and merchants power and wealth. And it was a warning to the church. If you recall, there was the come out of her. A warning to the church to not succumb to her offers of power and wealth. Babylon's sin was that she claims to be the supreme power who has the power to offer wealth, stability, and security to those who would follow her, those who would accept her ways. And she claims immunity from the natural consequences of her actions. She believes that she can act with impunity, that she can do whatever she wants, and there is no one above her that can, or that she can actually change the laws of nature. Part 1 ended with a description of her judgment and destruction being unbelievably quick. It comes in a day. Now, what was seen as unable to fall will fall. Babylon, this, what she claimed, what she believed to be eternal, what she believed herself to be eternal, never end. When her destruction comes, it is unbelievably, very surprisingly quick. And it is because God's power is mightier than Babylon's. Part 2, the middle section of chapter 18, contains 3 laments for Babylon. First, it was the kings. Kings lamenting because her power and her methods of maintaining her power have fallen. You know, the kings have based their power upon her ways. Her power. And that has fallen. It's been shown to be false. The merchants lament because her wealth and the means of acquiring them have fallen. The ways of luxury, the ways of wealth have fallen. And the seafarers lament because her means of maintaining order and stability that allowed the sea trade to flourish have fallen. So the kings, the merchants, and the seafarers lament. They're not sad that Babylon herself is gone, because Babylon is in competition with them. But they are sad. They lament because of what she represented has fallen. The principles, the methods, and the means of promoting self-indulgence, they have shown to be powerless. And the reminder as we read through these things is that it's not about these judgments, these calamities are not primarily about individual people in Revelation, but about systems. And I'm reminded of Ephesians 6:12, where Paul writes that the Christian church is battle is not against individuals, but it's about rulers and authorities. It's about the powers that rule the world. And so that brings us to part 3 of the fall of Babylon, which is essentially the aftermath of judgment. What happens? Verse 20 of chapter 18 begins, "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, So will Babylon the great city be thrown down with violence and will be found no more. And the sounds of harpists and musicians and flute players and trumpeters will be heard in you no more. And the craftsman of any craft will be found in you no more. And the sound of the mill will be heard in you no more. And the light of a lamp will shine in you no more. For your merchants were the great ones of the earth, and all nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slain on earth. And after this I heard what seemed to be the loud voice of a great multitude in heaven crying out, Hallelujah! Salvation and glory and power belong to our God, for his judgments are true and just. For he has judged the great prostitute who corrupted the earth with her immorality and has avenged on her the blood of his servants. Once more they cried out, Hallelujah! The smoke from her goes up forever and ever. And the 24 elders and the four living creatures fell down and worshipped God who was seated on the throne, saying, Amen, Hallelujah! And from the throne came a voice saying, Praise our God, all you his servants, you who fear him, small and great. Verse 20 is kind of a parenthetical aside, whose main theme is going to come back in chapter 19, verse 1. In this particular translation, verse 20 contains the phrase, For God has given judgment for you against her. The literal translation would read, God has judged your judgment from her.
So she's made a judgment and God has made a judgment about that.
Right. Babylon has been judging the saints all through history. Essentially, it is about, again, we come to the two different ways of living, two different ways of seeking life. One is Babylon's way, one is God's way. Babylon has been saying throughout her existence that God's way doesn't work, that my way works. And we have seen, and we see today, that, in fact, it seems to work pretty well most of the time. The world's ways work pretty well. And so the saints are being always accused of, your way doesn't work. But what verse 20 is saying is that at the end, it will be revealed that, in fact, the judgment that Babylon has been using against the saints will be used against her. So their alternative ways of stating that phrase is God has pronounced judgment for you against her, or God has pronounced on her the judgment she wished to impose on you. And this continues the theme that we have been seeing in Revelation. Evil will reap its own consequences.
What goes around comes around.
It reminds us of Matthew chapter 7, verse 2, where Jesus said, For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged. And with the measure you use it, it will be measured to you. So if your judgment is based on rewards and punishments, that is what you will get. If your judgment is based on grace and mercy, that is what you will get. Verses 21 through 24 of chapter 18, return to the judgment narrative. The millstone imagery comes from Jeremiah 51, verses 63 and 64, which reads, When you finish reading this book, tie a stone to it and cast it into the midst of the Euphrates and say, Thus shall Babylon sink to rise no more because of the disaster that I am bringing upon her, and they shall become exhausted. And thus far are the words of Jeremiah.
When you finish reading this book, the book?
The book that Jeremiah was writing things down. And so he was basically commanded to, as a parable, throw this book of judgment into the Euphrates. Now, Euphrates was the life of that area, of Babylon.
So, discard the, as in, throw away the judgment.
The judgment will throw it down into the sea.
Yeah, the words of the judgment represents Babylon itself in that case.
Okay.
I'm just saying it's not going to float again.
Yeah.
Once it's down, it's down.
It's not going to be rebuilt.
And when you see the Babylon, rise again.
The millstone itself, there's in that part of the world, there were two millstones, the upper stone and the lower stone. They were animals tied to the things that to move it around to mill the grain. And so they were very heavy. Uh-huh. Now you throw that in and you're not getting it back out. The point of this is that Babylon will not rise again. And possibly another imagery that John is trying to evoke is the idea that the sea represents the abyss. It represents chaos. You go back to the Genesis chapter 1, it is about the spirit begins hovering over, it opens with the spirit hovering over the waters. Waters, the sea represent chaos. Genesis 1 is about God bringing order to chaos. And so you could say that when Babylon is thrown into the sea, it is being returned to the chaos where everything began. It's an undoing of creation. These verses describe Babylon as completely deserted. It goes back to what we saw in verse 2 of chapter 18. Essentially, it's devoid of life. And what do we read here? We read that in 24, and in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slain on earth. It's, at least I find it ironic that it is death of prophets represented by the blood, which is usually the symbol of life, that are found in the city. So it's saying all these things are not found. No, they're not no more in the city, but then what's actually found in the city is the blood of the saints. You need to realize again that Revelation is not necessarily talking about literal martyrdom of individual people, but rather it is talking about the killing, the oppression of the church. It's part of a traditional theme that John uses. It's a literary device to describe what he is seeing in his visions. And in these verses now, the only prime instigator of evil that's mentioned are the merchants. But as we read through the chapter, we saw Babylon, the nations, the kings, the merchants, the seafarers. They're essentially all equally culpable in different ways. They are all not, they're both taking part in, but also promoting the system that Babylon represents. So Revelation points to the socio-economic system of Babylon as the primary evil that is condemned, at least in these chapters. It's a single-minded pursuit of power and wealth that inevitably leads to oppression and abuse.
being the human that I am, it's easy to see what they're pointing at, but I can't really see what the other side is. What's the good side?
Hold that question. Hold that question. Because I was at that same place this week trying to... I know all that is wrong with the systems
That's
of this
easy.
World. We look, whatever economics or political, social systems that we have in this world today, it inevitably leads to abuse. So what's the alternative? And I didn't like where that thought was led.
You put me.
What you see in every demolished city is that that's funny the way they use the blood of the saints, and you saying that it's usually the cornerstone of the good part. But what you're seeing is that you're seeing that system come to fruition and die because they didn't take the saints through their lineage with them. So what you see is basically a dead saint in front of you because they killed it by trying to create their city and trying to create their system. So yeah, it's a little bit hard to look at anymore because you don't necessarily have an answer.
Yeah. You look at any system that we have in this world, it's basically an expectation of hopefully equal exchange. We know that's not the case, but that is the essential basis, whatever you want to call it. It's an exchange of goods. Whereas you start looking at what God's system is, it's about unilateral giving. I mean, it is so foreign.
So what's unilateral mean?
Unilateral means there's no expectation of return.
One direction.
It's the commune.
It's not even commune, because even in the commune, you have the expectation that you're going to take care of one another.
You just give away and expect nothing in return.
Yeah.
It's just giving without expecting anything, just having it in your heart. It's like if somebody needs something.
Yeah, now if everyone has that attitude, behaves that way, then everything works out.
Yeah.
But as soon as there's the expectation of return, doesn't matter what system, things break down.
Are you answering my question?
I'm starting to.
Yes.
Okay. And well, that also gets back to what we were saying last week about you find something that works and it's great, and then you try to legislate it and reproduce it and tell somebody else you're going to do it this way.
You will give to the topics.
And then anymore.
That would assume that the top tier of our government right now is in a very happy place because they're getting everything with no expectation of return.
I don't think so.
My dad said that marriage is 100% giving. Not 50-50, but it's 100% giving. And in marriage, that's how it does work. You have to give 100%, not expect anything, and what marriages will work. And you're saying that goes to society.
They could work. You know, if both are giving 100% without expectations, it will work. But if one's giving 100% and one's taking 200%, it will work.
What you're saying makes sense. Not sure I can do it.
Yeah, that's...
So it's even tough in... And that's why it's crying to the church. Because in our churches, we lose sight of that every time we develop our church beyond a small congregation. Our church starts out with this just give attitude.
With this utopia.
Yeah, nothing.
This give attitude with no take attitude.
And then next thing you know, as soon as they develop more than and then it gets organized. And then there's the, we need this.
And then we start writing it down. And telling everybody. Comparing.
Like I said, boats are the only place where everything works.
Oh, no.
rewind it.
Actually, the folks are ideal as long as we all volunteer as oarsmen.
And we're volunteer oarsmen.
In a abundant society, what you're saying might have credence, but so the answer to that question is, if we follow that, we would be in abundance.
Absolutely.
That's the scary part.
Absolutely, but we are only human, and
the
second power enters into anything, anybody has power, it changes things because, you know, just who we are.
The second power becomes a factor at all. Yeah. It changes.
Well, I'm going to challenge you a little bit myself, but Jesus said no. Even if the society I live in does not honor this principle mutually, Jesus still lived it unilaterally.
But that's what he's saying. It's not saying that people are going to do that. It's saying if we did.
If.
All you're responsible for is for you to live that way. And that's where it comes in. Hey, giving without asking for receiving comes in too, because you're doing that because that's who you are. You're just going to do it. You're not expecting anyone else to do it. You're not going to get mad because, hey, everyone else isn't doing it. I'm doing it just because that's who I want to be. That's who Jesus wanted
to
be.
We're not going to expect society to actually become this.
Exactly how
that's the other message of Revelation is that the church is never going to change
the
systems of the world.
But
the church can change itself.
But we should still do it.
But we should still do it. Individual people can get out there and work to change the systems. But for the church to try to change the government,
that's easy and abundant.
Not even change, but to become. That's the real. That is the real problem that happens in the churches, is that they don't necessarily try to change, but inevitably they become, and that's the worst possible point.
And that's what you aren't to get sucked into the world systems.
It happens faster than you think, too. It's like
Sun City, Arizona, is a retirement community that a guy back in the 60s all the time told him. Dreamed up where older people could retire on very small economical homes, and because they're retired, everybody would volunteer, they would do everything, and the city is still viable today, and all the police force is voluntary, the garbage pickup is voluntary, everything is voluntary amongst that community of older folks. And it is, for retirement communities, it's a relatively small, cheap home. It kind of would.
Yeah. The description of the fall of Babylon ends with the scene returning to heaven with another song of praise. Now, we've pictured Revelation as dramatic theater, and you know, part of Greek theater frequently showed heaven, earth, and the underworld. And you might imagine that being shown here as well, the heaven, the earth, and the sea. Now, we've seen much of the action in this passage taking place on the earth, with a little bit of the sea as Babylon is thrown into the sea, the seafarers in the sea. Now, we see what's going on in heaven. They have the three choruses, the kings, the merchants, and the seafarers. Now there's another chorus in heaven who is singing this next section. So the earth's choruses are finished singing their lament. The sea has become Babylon's grave, and now heaven's chorus begins a song of praise. And once again, it's important to understand that saints are not rejoicing over the destruction of individual peoples here, but the destruction of an oppressive system. the great multitude that's singing, and we've identified this as synonymous to the saints who are God's servants, as well as the 144,000, different ways of looking at this group of people.
A lot of people.
A lot of people. The saints rejoice because God has been shown to be the source of true power and security. Now, their trust in God has been vindicated. And they, it has been shown that His ways of working with His creation are in fact just. So Babylon, the great prostitute, is judged for her corruption of power and justice.
Her injustice.
Well, yeah.
Her kind of justice.
Her kind of justice. The corruption of power and justice led to the oppression of those who, you know, who steadfastly, faithfully held to God's ways, God's justice. And so the smoke from her, from Babylon, goes up forever and ever. Again, it's about false systems of power, not about people. It's not talking about eternal hell, where people burn forever and ever. It's talking about its imagery, saying that this system is gone forever.
That's wonderful.
This false system will never rise again.
But even more than just that, it's actually a spirit song. Not a spirit song, but like it's like a cheerleader for people that believe in God's way. It's more of like here's something to lift your spirit up. Is that God has shown all those that truly believe in His heart that is the system that will win, that has won, and it's going to. It's you have no reason to worry that.
We return to the throne room scene in heaven. The 24 elders and the four living creatures have always appeared next to God's throne. They have been singing praises, worshiping all throughout Revelation, except for the brief period when the seventh trumpet is sounded.
We hear a lot about 24 elders and four living creatures. Is there more to it than just do they actually stand for something?
Like perfection and unity.
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe we'll find out more later.
This is their last appearance in the book of Revelation. We've seen them appear from time to time. They come in to kind of introduce scenes, to take part in different scenes that happen in Revelation.
Mm-hmm. It's the cabinet.
I think it's more of a dramatic device than anything.
Ah, okay. Introduction. Pull in the new screen.
Yeah. And then verse 5, there's a voice from the throne. This is a kind of a transitional verse. Depending on commentaries and translations, this verse is either the end of the current section or the beginning of the next section. So it's a transitional verse. Whose voice is speaking? Well, that's a good question. A voice saying, "Praise our God, all you His servants, you who fear Him, small and great." Well, God Himself can't be saying, "Praise our God." It's kind of redundant and kind of silly.
So, it's almost like instead of saying that the 24 elders and that imagery would be more like the kings, the merchants, and the seafarers for Babylon, then they would be you know, because here you have Babylon, which is their great praise, mm-hmm. the thing mm-hmm. that they see the highest. And you kind of never see Babylon as an individual or as a, you know,
right.
being.
Babylon is going to be mirrored parallel mm-hmm. by the New Jerusalem that is going to be appearing over the next few chapters.
Right, and so throughout Revelations we've been seeing where evil would marry itself to the image of God and have its court mm-hmm. mirror that imagery of God. So when John is explaining the throne and then the elders the saints and all of the people around it, it almost is the same story when you're reading about Babylon, because Babylon never really actually speaks for itself. She says a few times that she's controlled her thing and said who she is, but never has actually addressed the story with its own words. So it kind of seems to me that court would be a way of mirroring that cynicism or whatever.
And if you look at it as a dramatic production, those people are like the repeating court.
It have to picture it as a drama, because throughout there's parallels of the good versus evil.
Right.
And there are corresponding parallels throughout.
And they do kind of always come in when they come in to explain the victory, or they come in to precede the coming of God himself, or something like that. So it seems that they're the kind of opposite side of the protagonist of the story, so you have Babylon or the great beast or the sea, and each time those individuals are portrayed, they have their the people that disagree, or the court that's destroyed, the saints that get killed, and so each time those individuals show up, they show up in the same sequence as they did in Evil.
And as for why certain things are portrayed a certain way, I think there's still a lot we don't understand about Revelation. And if we try to claim to understand every bit of it, I think we're overthinking it and not getting into the minds of the people who originally read it. And
that's a hard part.
Yeah, and maybe some of these things meant different things than even the research that we've been able to find out.
So who's speaking in this verse 5? We recall back quite a ways now, and we talked about thrones in the ancient Near East, or the Middle East. Thrones were not just this object where a single person sat. They were usually larger, almost couches, you might say, where multiple individuals could sit together. So we said that God is on the throne, but also the Lamb. God and the Lamb share this throne. And so who else is on the throne? The Lamb. So then it would make sense that the Lamb would also speak from the throne. And so it makes no sense to see this Lamb speaking, praise our God. Because the Lamb has said similar things in the past in this book. And this phrase, all you his servants, you who fear him, small and great, this is an echo back to the seventh trumpet in chapter 11, verse 18, where the sounding of the seventh trumpet announced that judgment has commenced. And this read, the nations raged, but your wrath came, and the time for the dead to be judged, and for rewarding your servants, the prophets and saints, for those who fear your name, both small and great, and for destroying the destroyers of the earth. That 11:18 was one bookend. 19 verse 5 is another bookend. It's essentially saying the bulk of judgment is found between these two verses. Chapter 19 is the conclusion of what began with the seventh trumpet sounding, the judgment. And now we get to a discussion of the socio-economic systems. The question that Jerry started to ask. What does success look like? What does success look like for the world?
Money, power.
Prestige, power, money, influence, security,
control, over creation, over man, over all aspects, and design.
What does success look like for you, or for me?
almost all of those
things. Almost all, yeah, doesn't it?
Yeah. Ability to create yourself.
What does success look like for Jesus? That's the question. That's the question. Does our view of success determine the socioeconomic system that we buy into?
Absolutely.
I guess I'm wondering about the word success. Is our ultimate goal success, happiness, joy? What?
Depends on what you mean by success.
Yeah.
But
what is
it? No, it is contentment. Because true success comes from a content personality with their ability. You know, it doesn't come from their ability to do it better than somebody else. It comes from their content with their ability. So you can have somebody that enjoys playing music but isn't very good at it, or you can have somebody that enjoys playing music so much that they're good at it, but neither one of those people consider themselves better than the other or worse than the other, because they are content with their ability to enjoy the thing that they are doing.
So you're saying content is at the top of the deal is contentment.
It's not even the top, it is. It's the absolute.
Well, let's go on.
I say absolute because...
Because that's your character. Everything down
the road. I say that because everybody that I see struggling is generally struggling from the lack of content with their situation, or content that they have the ability and have been given the ability to make their situations change with the right motive. Okay, I'll stop. Sorry.
Okay.
I apologize.
That was the right question.
That is your view of success.
If it doesn't come out my way now, then...
The scripture has a lot to say about socioeconomic systems. At Mount Sinai, Moses wrote down what the Israelites' system should look like. We find maybe the best summary of that in chapter 25 of Leviticus, where it talks about the Sabbath year, every seventh year, the year of Jubilee. That's after the seven sets of 7 years. The redemption of property and kindness for poor brothers and redeeming a poor man. It's a long, fairly long chapter, but I think, you know, it's important because it provides, I think, a foundation for what a system based on alternative socioeconomic principles might look like. So Leviticus chapter 25. The Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you, the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. For 6 years you shall sow your field, and for 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its fruits. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. You shall not reap what grows of itself in your harvest, or gather the grapes of your undressed vine. It shall be a year of solemn rest for the land. The Sabbath of the land shall provide food for you, for yourself, and for your male and female slave, and for your hired worker, and the sojourner who lives with you, and for your cattle, and for the wild animals that are in your land. All its yield shall be for food." So that's the Sabbath year. Every 7 years, you take the entire year off. What would happen to today's world if an entire nation shut down for a year?
Post gas.
Wow.
But are you shutting down in the aspect it says we'll all be
it doesn't mean
food.
Nobody does anything.
It doesn't mean it doesn't it's not saying that it's that
they
you have done nothing to provide for that seventh year.
You're agrarian.
You've done your work, you've done your deed, and now on that seventh year, you're not supposed to toil for that deed of that year. You're supposed to take a reaping of the entirety of the 7 years and enjoy the fruit of that 7 year labor.
Did you have a preparation year that you laid in double?
Well, what it's basically saying is you worked through 6 years, and your seventh year will be provided for.
Well, a farmer can do that.
In other words,
how
do
you go beyond the farmer?
Trust God to provide for that year. The land gets to rest too, right?
The land.
I just don't understand how it goes beyond a farmer.
That's one of the difficulties of trying to apply what's here to today. But there is that principle. There is that principle that, and it goes back to, this is part of the entire Sabbath series of things. First of all, there's the weekly Sabbath. Every 7 days, the seventh day, you do not work. Which for a farmer could be a very difficult choice.
Because it's good weather and you need to...
Especially during harvest time.
Well, then you'd be dairy when you still got to do it.
Or even in planting. You want to plant when it's muddy.
Right. Planting's a little more flexible.
Yeah.
But harvest can... the weather...
And the whole crop that you've grown.
Harvest can be the most difficult time.
So you don't have to take them all at the same time.
Well, see, that's the thing, though. Like, man, one day can be a long day.
Wanting to work, I want to work, I want to work, I want to work. Well, that's no rest. There's no rest in that.
No, I mean, what if it's not even a Saturday or Sunday thing? It's that even on that one Saturday that you may be taking off from the actual harvest point of something, you could have broken machinery. You could have things that need to be addressed to be able to work on the day after Saturday. So it doesn't matter just the one thing that you're trying to do. The entirety of the operation hinges on your consistent work all the time.
The systems of the world are based on the assumption that you have to bring in resources so that you can live.
Yeah, right.
Sustain yourself.
And if you're going to
the Sabbath sequence, the daily Sabbath, the yearly Sabbath, and we'll see with the year of the Jubilee, the seven sets of seven leading to the 50th year, which is also taken off, so that's 2 years off in a row, is basically, it's a way of rebelling against the tyranny of the world system. Is saying, I don't have to follow what the world says I have to follow.
I can trust God to provide for my needs.
So, on the day, what's the daily Sabbath?
Well, there is no daily. It's every seventh day.
Every seventh day, every seventh year. Yeah. And then.
So, there's no daily Sabbath. There's nothing that.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds good on paper, but if I was a doctor, I could say, okay, I'm going to doctor for 6 years, then the seventh year I'm not going to charge anybody. I'm just going to abuse people harder for 6 years, so that the seventh year I'm just floating through.
Or you can trust God doing that.
Well, direct applications don't work, but we'll see how people are protected as we continue through this chapter.
That was the question. Did it ever work?
We'll get to that. So the year of the Jubilee, you shall count 7 weeks of years, 7 times 7 years, so that the time of the 7 weeks of year shall give you 49 years. Then you shall sound the loud trumpet on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement you shall sound the trumpet throughout all your land. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you when each of you shall return to his property and each of you shall return to his clan. That 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of itself, nor gather the grapes from the undressed vines, for it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You may eat the produce of the field. In this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his property, and if you make a sale to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor, you shall not wrong one another. You shall pay your neighbor according to the number of years after the Jubilee, and he shall sell to you according to the number of years for crops. See, private ownership of land did not exist. It's a tenant farming system where God is the owner, and you are leasing the land. And so what you are selling, buying and selling is the right to farm the land and to use it, the fruit that comes from it. So if the years are many, you shall increase the price, and if the years are few, you shall reduce the price. For it is the number of crops that he is selling to you. You shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. Therefore you shall do my statutes and keep my rules and perform them, and then you will dwell in the land securely. You want security? Here's the way to it.
So it's the stewardship,
it's the stewardship
ideology.
Yeah.
So the seventh year taking the time off is the land's healing time. It's the time for you to let this resource regain and rebuild.
Yeah. It does make sense from a more modern scientific perspective, but you know, why can't you just rotate the land then? You know, what this is, it's not just the land, it's the people.
Yeah.
The people need to understand that they do not work for themselves.
Right.
They do not work for others. They belong to God.
Yeah. So that's awesome. You know why it's awesome? Because you have a farmer in your, you live in a farming community. This entire community is based on a farming mentality beyond what most people in a structured environment live in. Because you have your smaller instances around our country where it's people living off the land or maintaining an existence from it, but it's usually isolated and it's own little town that has that resource. But here, we live in a community that's almost completely based around the farming activity that's happening around us. And whether it's forestry or fishing, it is what has made this place what it is. And to say that we should take that time off is like, would dumbfound us completely. You mean you're telling the entire state of Alaska to take an entire year? And if we took a day off every week, really a day off, and everybody took it off and didn't fish, then that would take care of a lot of our things that we do with our fishing, to let things go by, to let that land and that resource generate itself.
If you let it rest, somebody else will snatch it up.
Tomorrow we'll abuse it twice as much.
So continuing here, verse 19, the land will yield its fruit and you will eat your fill and dwell in it securely. And if you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year, if we may not sow or gather in our crop? I will command my blessing on you in the sixth year, so that it will produce a crop sufficient for 3 years. When you sow in the eighth year, you will be eating some of the old crop. You shall eat the old until the ninth year, when its crop arrives. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine.
See, in essence, we are doing that with our fisheries. We have quotas, and we have allotments, and we have openings. So in essence, it's kind of that way with fisheries.
So you have 4 days on, 3 days off, 4 days on.
No, we don't have that, because you know what happens? The corruption of the people managing those systems is deeper than you could ever imagine, and then at the point of the time when you believe that you have rightfully itemized the system, it falls. And it falls completely. And then you know what happens after that? They shut everything down, lock it up, and it's never utilized again until they quote-unquote believe that it's okay.
Those
and then just like you say, the world system lets you go full board again. And gives you 52,000 king salmon, and then you don't see king salmon for another 6 years. So
7 according to this. 49. Yeah.
So the land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the country you possess, you shall allow a redemption of the land. If your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. If a man has no one to redeem it, and then himself becomes prosperous and finds sufficient means to redeem it, let him calculate the years since he sold it, and pay back the balance to the man to whom he sold it, and then return to his property. In other words, when you sell a property and you buy it back, you're going to pay less for it. You know, people do not make... In Israel, you are not supposed to make a profit on real estate.
Real estate?
Well, there was no real estate.
You're supposed to do what's right. You're not supposed to have gain.
But if he does not have sufficient means to recover it, then what he sold shall remain in the hand of the buyer until the year of Jubilee. In the Jubilee it shall be released, and he shall return to his property. If a man sells a dwelling house in a walled city, he may redeem it within a year of its sale. For a full year he shall have the right of redemption. If it is not redeemed within a full year, then the house and the walled city shall belong in perpetuity to the buyer throughout his generations. It shall not be released in the Jubilee.
What?
Walled houses within a walled city is not considered property. It's considered an object that can
be... So you own it for... It's personal property.
Yeah.
So you own it forever.
But the houses of the villages that have no wall around them shall be classified with the fields of the land.
Get rid of those rocks in the field.
They may be redeemed, and they shall be released into Jubilee. This is showing God's priority. God's priority is not in big business. Now, that's where what happens in cities. Now, he acknowledges, God acknowledges that, yes, it's going to happen. And here are some rules governing property within cities. But I would rather have each person work for his own, to bring in what he needs without focus on excessive gain, excessive profit.
It sounds good on paper. Did it ever even get off the ground?
We'll get to that.
Don't wait for that. 7 days.
As for the cities, the Levites may redeem at any time the houses and the cities they possess. Levites are a different class.
Oh, of course.
And if one of the Levites exercises, because they were not given any land. And if one of the Levites exercises the right of redemption, then the house that was sold in a city they possess shall be released in the Jubilee. For the houses and the cities of the Levites are their possession among the people of Israel. But the fields of pasture land belonging to their cities may not be sold, for that is their possession forever. If your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner, and he shall live with you. Take no interest from him or profit, but fear your God, that your brother may live beside you. You shall not lend him your money at interest, nor give him your food for profit. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. If your brother becomes poor beside you and sells himself to you, so there's the first stage is he's too poor to support himself, but maybe he still has land that he can work. Well, the community is supposed to care for that person. Second stage is he becomes even poorer, and maybe he's lost his land. He has no means of himself to generate what he needs for himself. So he sells himself to you. You shall not make him serve as a slave. He shall be with you as a hired worker and as a sojourner. He shall serve with you until the year of the Jubilee. Then he shall go out from you, he and his children with him, and go back to his own clan and return to the possession of his fathers, for they are my servants whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves. You shall not rule over him ruthlessly, but shall fear your God. As for your male and female slaves whom you may have, you may buy male and female slaves from among the nations that are around you. You may also buy from among the strangers who sojourn with you and the clans that are with you, who have been born in your land, and they may be your property. You may bequeath them to your sons after you to inherit as a possession forever. You may make slaves of them, but over your brothers, the people of Israel, you shall not rule over one over another ruthlessly. These laws.
So are foreign slaves freed at the Jubilee?
No.
No.
No? Oh,
no.
Wow.
Okay.
Let's go play Canaan.
Because according in this, the Israelites' worldview, they were the people of the covenant. Under the covenant, all members are brothers and sisters. They are all equal under God. You cannot own another brother or sister because God is your ultimate owner. Now, when it comes to the other nations, well, they are governed by different gods. They're not under the covenant.
So are the people of Israel considered a genealogical people? Like, if you're from another nation, you could believe in Christ, but just because you do doesn't mean that you are a person of Israel?
There wasn't Christ yet, but... could people become Israelites?
They have.
People?
That's my question, yeah.
It was probably not a very common occurrence.
Uh-huh. So it meant birth. You had a birthright to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, it was genetic.
So how does that even begin to compare with... anything that's right in the system of the world, because then you're basically saying that all of the rest of the human population of the planet are damned anyway.
No, I don't think we're going to try to
mixing up the Old Testament, New Testament, and how the laws are and before
the
after.
Not what should be.
The covenant did not identify those who are saved.
Right.
It identified who belonged to Israel.
Right.
The Jews at Jesus' time, what they believed was essentially that the Gentiles could be saved. They didn't have to follow the covenant, but there were seven laws that they believed had been, you know, through legend, had been given to Noah. And if Gentiles obeyed those seven laws, then they were saved.
If everybody was nice, a Christian in the Old Testament, and there was zero population growth, I could see that might have a chance. But with population growth, I just don't see how.
The genetic getting more property to feed the
animals. Lemmings. Every 7 years.
You know, the Old Testament definitely is written based upon that particular viewpoint. A particular viewpoint which does not necessarily fully express God's perspective.
So Moses was reflecting Moses, or was Moses reflecting God?
Maybe both. A little both.
You see, in a infinite natural resources, such as the United States had in the 1800s, you can have a certain type of a social economic system. But once you have limited resources, everything changes. And at that time, I would presume that Canaan was... You know, they thought that the forest would last forever. They thought that the natural resources would last forever. And are you saying that if we followed that principle, natural resources would last forever? Not with population growth.
Maybe if you follow God's way, and the Sabbaths and the Jubilee, and if you follow them with the right attitude about them, maybe the resources would last forever.
Well, if they have too many Sabbaths, they will have even more and more kids.
Oh, my God.
Well, I think the thing is that man looks at something that's there and they think of it as unlimited, but ultimately you're not supposed to think of the land as unlimited. You're supposed to restrict your use of it as to what you need, not as to what you can gain. And that's why they were skewed in their ideology of an unlimited force, because they were using it to gain, and of course when they did, their lust for the gain that they were going for was overwhelming, and you can see the impact of that.
The last few verses here, Leviticus 25. If a stranger or sojourner with you becomes rich, and your brother beside him becomes poor and sells himself to the stranger or sojourner with you, or to a member of the stranger's clan, then after he is sold, he may be redeemed. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle or his cousin may redeem him, or a close relative from his clan may redeem him, or if he grows rich, he may redeem himself. He shall calculate with his buyer from the year when he sold himself to him until the year of Jubilee, and the price of his sale shall vary with the number of years. The time he was with the work owner shall be rated as the time of a hired worker. If there are still many years left, he shall pay proportionately for his redemption some of his sale price. But if there remain but a few years until the year of Jubilee, he shall calculate and pay for his redemption in proportion to his years of service. He shall treat him as a worker hired year by year. He shall not rule ruthlessly over him in your sight, and if he is not redeemed by these means, then he and his children with him shall be released in the year of Jubilee. For it is to me that the people of Israel are servants. They are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God.
That makes it sound not so old.
And elsewhere there is a command saying, that just because, oh, you only have a few years until the year of Jubilee, you're not supposed to abuse them. Part of the law of Israel is that just because the year of Jubilee is coming up, you are not to abuse your people who have sold themselves to you.
Don't take advantage of that.
So it really isn't that God has singled out Israel to be his one and only people. It's more like he singled out Israel to be like the church is supposed to be.
That's what they were supposed to be. They were supposed to witness to the world.
And to witness to, and so the other nations of the world.
Yeah, what was the original promise to Abraham, where all of this begins, is Abraham is going to be a blessing to all nations,
right?
Not just Israel.
So it's hard when you have grown in a... See, here's my baggage, Jerry. When you've grown in a when you've grown into a world where your offense to somebody that says that they have more of a right than you is so strong that when you have a hard time even accepting the idea that God would take a nation of people and
who believed they were genetically superior,
that was what was right, and that you couldn't see the good in that. And so, like, growing up and being in a world that I grew up in where not necessarily my ethnicity and where I was growing up was acceptable, because I had no right to be there because I had oppressed or not been part of the society that was oppressed. So it makes you feel over time like, wait a minute, why is anybody more special than anybody else? We should all be equal, and there should be nobody more special. But basically, after listening further, it's an example like the church. The church is not supposed to feel that they're better, not supposed to exude and expect and tell, but just example the grace that God gives. And that's my baggage. That's where I have a hard time thinking that, oh, well, this group of people can be better. So I've always recoiled from a church or from an example, because they've always, in some way, shape, or form, made their presence rather than given. And so It's always, so even listening to that little passage, like, oh, well, these Israelites think that they're just the ones because they're genetically better than me.
Uh-huh.
And
uh-huh.
immediately my heart just went, no,
you really
can't
have
do
that.
That
short. I wouldn't expect you to have short pants. I wrote
that. But
I can come back again. I like you.
I do find that I think that's right uh-huh. where I'm at, is where a lot of people instantly become, oh, well,
turn off.
That can't be right.
You turn off instantly.
Yeah. The temptation for the agricultural society of that time was you work, because you have to survive,
mm-hmm.
and maybe you can make a little more than you need.
Well, I've been thinking on that word you use is gain.
Gain.
Manna came and you ate it, and if you tried to save it, it didn't work. If you get exactly what you need, you're fine. But if you get more than you need, there's absolutely no value in getting more than you need. If we would go to the woods and get the lumber that we need, everything would be fine. It's when we get more than we need that we get in trouble.
Yeah, I think that's what the Israelite socioeconomic system was supposed to be based on, meeting the needs and not going beyond it.
3 years of firewood.
Based on, I go out and get what is needed to meet my needs.
Meet my needs and the needs of those around us. Around
Native Americans,
if someone else doesn't have enough, then I can get enough to meet my needs and his too.
Right.
The Native
but
Americans, that's what they
get five times as much as I need so I can sell a bunch of it and make more money so I can stand over my neighbor and look down on him, is when you get resource depletion and everything else that is that.
So that does reflect on the Native American who have no point in gaining more than they need, and it kind of works. Can you take that economy and make it work in our society today?
Not today.
Yeah, that's why it's such a difficult topic.
You still have the human aspect of it, so there's still
greed.
Greed is in there.
Alive and well.
And so you're going to still try to find, hey, all right, you know, I can get a little extra here, a little extra there, be one up somebody, because though we try, as we should, to live that way, we will fight against ourselves.
What?
So, the question, there was a question, did Israel ever follow these laws?
Yes, I did have that question, but it come to mind.
They may have sporadically. The Jubilee, there is no record whatsoever.
Of it really happening.
Of it really happening.
Really?
Of everybody getting their property back.
Yeah.
Like, give it back.
Now, after the Babylonian exile, the Jews apparently were quite meticulous in following at least a sabbatical year, every 7 years. Because there is actually some record of it saying that some people suffered from hunger during the seventh year.
So was Moses a visionary that, come on, not a realist? I mean, what did they perceive Moses to write? If Moses was their God, not their God, but their hero,
mm-hmm.
and did he become a hero in his lifetime, or was he a hero a thousand years later?
He was a leader then.
He was looked up to.
Okay, so when did they...
That's who they complained to. We have a record of that.
I say hero because by the time you get to New Testament, there is nobody more glorious than Moses.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Moses was absolutely it. Nothing above.
So why did they say Moses is our hero, but then everything he wrote was hogwash?
Because we're human.
It's not like Ellen G. White. We like Ellen G. White, but we don't like what she wrote.
So, I don't know. So, let's go into the New Testament. What are some of the things that Jesus said about this topic? We'll start with Luke 12.
On socioeconomics.
Luke 12, 16 to 21.
Don't build a barn.
If you have it, you'll lose
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's the first one. He told them a parable saying, the land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, what shall I do, for I have nowhere to store my crops? And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.
I am the center of my will.
Next, I want to turn to Matthew chapter 20. Matthew 20.
Tell me to go to the lilies of the field, the birds.
Not quite. We'll get
You're
to that. We'll get
quite.
To that.
This is
laborers in the vineyard. For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And to them he said, you go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you. So they went, going out again about the sixth hour, and the ninth hour he did the same. And about the 11th hour he went out and found others standing, and he said to them, why do you stand here idle all day? They said to him, because no one has hired us. He said to them, you go into the vineyard too. And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first. And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius.
He could have started with the first and gone to the last. Then they would have all been happy.
Now when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, these last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us, who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. But he replied to one of them, friend, I am not doing you no wrong. I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity? So the last will be first, and the first last.
So human. Oh, we're so good at that.
God has given everybody the same heart, the same number of heartbeats.
Matthew chapter 6 now.
Maybe. Not.
Matthew chapter 6, verse 11. This is part of the Lord's Prayer. Give us this day our daily bread.
Our daily gain.
Not.
No, your need, not your gain.
Not yesterday's bread, nor tomorrow's bread, but today. Then we continue down to verse 19. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Then jumping down to verse 25. Therefore, I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? And why are you anxious about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? And therefore do not be anxious, saying, what shall we eat? Or what shall we drink? Or what shall we wear? For the Gentiles seek after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them all. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. And the last passage is about, in regards to what Jesus said about these things, I'd like to take is John 19. John 19, 23. When the soldiers had crucified Jesus, they took his garments and divided them into four parts, one part for each soldier, also his tunic. But the tunic was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. So they said to one another, "Let us not tear it, but cast lots for it to see whose it shall be." This was to fulfill the scripture which says, "They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots." So the soldiers did these things. But standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her to his own home. Now, what does this last passage in John have anything to do with socioeconomics?
Taking care of his mother.
Yeah, it's not. The soldiers took everything that Jesus owned, which wasn't much. But in spite of that, Jesus' primary concern was, who's going to take care of my mother?
That's a Mother's Day sermon.
But you got it on the first of the year.
And it is at this point that is church. That at the core of church, of what Christian church is supposed to be,
is looking after.
It's about taking care of one another's needs.
Right.
Well, there's all these other things is side issues. And you know, we won't take time to look at the next part, but throughout Acts, the early Christians tried the best they could to imitate what Jesus did with his mother at the cross.
Taking care of
one another.
Well, I think one of the things that I would have said that what meant this meant to Jesus would be that we had the freedom to choose. We had the freedom to choose him or the world. And that was important for him. You know, and he was able to give us that choice through the cross, that we could have a choice. And we can have a choice to help people or not help people. We can have a choice to trust Jesus or think we gotta trust ourselves. But he gave us that choice. That was his success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what Jesus in his parables and his actions showed is that, you know, what the resources that his followers have do not belong to them. It is ultimately God's. Just as the land in Israel was ultimately God's. And so each person is given, is lent, is made a steward of a certain part of God's kingdom in order to utilize those things to the best of their abilities to take care of one another.
You can grow old and be grateful, or you can grow old and blame.
So
like, does that work with Ray's concept of being content? I kind of think it does.
Trust.
It also comes to the effect that, like, because last week, I also asked about a week before that, I asked about how like, when we say we're going to take on the life of Christ or people that are pretty kind of fanatical about taking on this the cross, they tend to cast away all of the world and society and say, I can't be rich, I have to be poor, I can't partake of any of this. But it's not saying that you can't do that. It's saying that the bounty that is yours can be yours to enjoy as long as you're willing to enjoy expressing that with everybody and giving it to anybody that needs it around you that you can afford to do that for.
Yeah.
And if you can do that for yourself and anybody that you feel you need to do that with, then it's okay to enjoy the things that you've obtained, I guess, is what I'm asking. Because there's that fine line that's always there in the back of your mind because you're enjoying what you do. Mm-hmm. And you try to do as much as you can. If you try to do as much as you can for other people, then it's okay to enjoy having something that maybe other people don't have because you're willing to give that up if you had to take care of other people.
If giving becomes an obligation that you have to do, that you think you have to do, it's no longer a joy and there's no point in doing it.
Or if you're doing it for show off or something.
Sacrificially giving.
You know,
so if you've obtained wealth, but you're freely in your heart willing to just take care of whoever's around you, no matter whether it's for show or not for show, but just to take care of people and to let other people be part of your wealth, that's the point you're trying to make. You're not doing it because, oh, okay, I've obtained this, so I better make sure I give enough of it away to make everybody feel good.
Yeah.
One big problem is in agrarian society that they're talking about in their culture, the relationship between what you do and the recipient is pretty real close to each other, where in today's society it's so far removed.
It is, and that's why I don't think God ever wanted that to take place.
I agree. I fully agree.
The saying in the Bible is the love of money is the root of all evil, but in some ways money is the root of all evil as well, because money is a proxy for time, ability, efforts. Money distances people from everything.
I think it was a wheel. Yeah. If it wasn't for the wheel, we couldn't transport stuff anywhere, and we'd all be right where we were.
No, that's true. We could have done canals all over the world.
Nope.
He had a boat.
Oh, yeah, true. Boat.
It has a wheel.
Money separates us from consumption, production and consumption. Money is separate.
So even if you go the barter, it's the exchange that's the problem.
Yeah.
It's just give. Don't exchange, give.
Instead of giving of ourselves, of our time, we give money.
That's right.
Because it's a lot more convenient. Charities ask for money because it's more efficient. It's more convenient.
Oh, yeah.
No, you don't have to train half a dozen new volunteers to go help with something over there. But in God, economy is not about efficiency. Now, if God wanted efficiency, I'm sure He would have designed something much better than what we have today.
Well, it's our idea of efficiency.
Yeah.
You know, our idea of efficiency isn't His.
God's economy is based on interpersonal relationships.
Well, that's where life is. I just complained to Dolores this morning. We don't socialize like we always ideally think we used to in the olden days. Well, that's what life is. So
I told him to start socializing.
That's right.
We need to continue here. But so, what is the reason for the church? Why does the church exist?
Social.
To provide an atmosphere for socializing.
And to inspire us, and you do it every single time.
Is it a micro social economic?
Provide a setting in which people meet each other's needs?
Just to provide us, one reason.
Do we meet your needs at all?
Well, yeah.
You meet our needs, but the other way around.
He has a pitchfork, he keeps jabbing.
Matthew 25, 31 to the end of the chapter. When the Son of Man comes in His glory and all His angels with Him, then He will sit on His glorious throne. Before Him will be gathered all the nations, and He will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And He will place the sheep on His right, but the goats on the left. Then the King will say to those on His right, Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will answer them, Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these my brothers, you did it to me. Then he will say to those on his left, Depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. And naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they also will answer, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister to you? Then he will answer them, saying, Truly I say to you, as you did not do it for one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, the righteous into eternal life. That, for me, in the context of what we're discussing, discusses the right attitude of church versus the wrong attitude of church.
So I'm going to ask Ray, maybe there is one more pinnacle above contentment, and that is we are the happiest typically when we're giving of what we're comfortable of giving. And what I'm
so contentment. How about uncomfortable of giving?
when I give of my talent, it's giving. It's a socializing. It's a gift.
My grandfather once said, "A gift is the most selfish thing you can do."
Depending on how you do it.
No. If I don't know why I'm always so red wrong, but I the point of the gift. Being selfish is because it is something that we, if you are content, do so willingly that it's almost more jubilistic, it's almost more refreshing to you to give that gift when you can give it satisfactorily, when you can give it with what you have at the best you can.
So satisfying for the giver.
Yeah.
Yeah. The sheep in this parable, the way I read it right now is what it seems to say. The sheep take care of one another, and they do it because they want to.
You show me a sheep that does that.
we're not talking about literal sheep.
You know, when you drove in, we were all going bad.
The sheep take care of one another. They give because they want to, and they don't even think about it. The goats, they're giving. Grudgingly.
They look for the right person to give.
They're doing it because they have to, because maybe they can get something out of it. There's nothing in here that says they didn't do it.
They're looking for Jesus to give to him. Where can I find the person that I'm supposed to give to that will give me credit?
What do you mean? I never saw you. It's like, yep, you never saw me.
So the three words at the top of the pinnacle are contentment, give, and faith. And faith being that it's real close relative to contentment.
Or trust.
Yeah.
So what does a successful church look like?
Successful people. Successful people are people who have those three things.
People feel loved.
Yeah.
Cared for.
Everyone trusts God for their needs, and so you don't have to worry about your needs, so you can give to everyone around you.
Appreciate what each person brings to the table.
Without looking for anything back. And you don't look for the right people to give to that will get you credit.
In an idealistic...
You give to whoever needs.
In an idealistic society, in the good old days, a doctor enjoys being a doctor, and he's going to serve the people. And engineers love to build, so they're going to build for the people. And everybody's going to do their talent, and the society as a whole will be fulfilled.
But you run into a fine line because of who we are.
you've got to give because you want to give, but there's a fine line of giving.
Well, if
because
all you're
the
giving,
faith you think it's going to give, you're going to get more blessings from God because you're giving. Instead of giving
because
just because
credit for it.
You want to give.
Well, let's say you can't give money. Money got it.
No, I have no money.
I know. So, but nobody has any money. Okay, so now give.
Well,
you give to your boys.
It's just like you drive. Say you're driving out the road. There's a guy. He's got a tree down. He's struggling. He's an old guy. You know, split wood. Looks like he shouldn't even be there. You stop. You help him. You split his wood. You load it in the truck. You do everything for him. Help him out. Because you want to. Mm-hmm. You're getting nothing out of that.
But
you're not, you may never see him again. It doesn't matter. You're not asking for anything.
And you're not doing it so that you can store up cash and have
no
spending.
You're just doing it just because, hey.
And he was out there because he was trying to provide.
I'm not talking about charity.
it also goes into doing things like to learning something also, because we always put ourselves in positions where we feel that if we're learning something, we have to learn it faster and better and be good at it quick enough to make sure that other people find it attractive or worth their time or worth being around and doing. And we quite often are that way with our faith too. Like, we feel that we have to prove enough quickly enough so that people understand that we believe enough that we're doing it that way.
You know? and so it's
like that with everything. I mean, what's going on in our fiddle group right now is amazing, because so many people say, oh, that's so cool that you're doing that. It would be so much fun. I'd love to come. But they will not come because they're afraid that their inability to be good enough at what they're doing would offend people. And it ultimately offends themselves, against themselves, to try to do something that they're going to do.
Because of making themselves look insufficient.
Now, if Mark can't play his flute, he sounds so much better.
we as society have not learned. The older you get, you learn it, but we haven't learned. It's the process that is, it's the journey, it's not the accomplishment. We think it's the reward of playing perfect. It's the process of getting there that is where true life is found.
Well, you don't want to offend people. You sound so awful either.
It's the learning.
But it's the togetherness of the learning.
It really is, because I'll tell you right now, it is so much more fun to go play that instrument with everybody else than it is to sit in the room and try to play by myself. I can't stand it. I can't even get through three songs when I sit there and play that instrument to hear myself play it. And I've gotten to the same point with helicopters. I don't even care to fly the stupid thing when I'm by myself anymore. It's like, so what?
Nobody's there to watch it.
It's not that there's nobody there to watch it. It's that the
life
trying to impress myself with it is pointless.
You've done that already.
I know what my ability with it is, and I enjoy doing that to an extent. I have fun doing it, and it's enjoyable, and I want to do it, but I always want to do it more when there's a body of people that are happy to be doing it with me.
Cheering
the social.
So, we are in a group of sheep, and we're always afraid that someone's going to introduce a goat into our perfect society. That's not the problem. We're not looking out for some goat that's going to mess us up. The problem is, each one of us has goat in us.
Yep.
So, it's
your hair can get straight.
Wrap up here. So, kind of a summary of today here. Revelation is a critique of how the world seeks to establish safety, security, stability, and comfort. The world can ultimately only offer these things to those who have the means to afford them. And these means are secured by power, and this kind of power inevitably leads to abuses and dehumanizes those who are under it. That's why God is against it. Revelation, then, is a warning to the church that her very mission is compromised when she utilizes the world's methods. The church does not seek safety and security in the physical temporal kingdom. The church does not seek stability and comfort because the temporal kingdom is inherently unstable. It's only stable because of power. It's inherently unstable, and comfort only deceives. You're comfortable, and so you're deceived that, oh, everything's going to be okay, when everything is not. The church already possesses eternal security, so why do you have to seek? Why does the church have to seek security from anywhere else? The church is free to use the resources she is lent, not to secure her own future, but to meet the needs of those that have been entrusted into her care.
That's heavy against building the church in the first place.
It is.
It's heavy.
You know, if Jesus wanted to establish a religion, he would have established a religion.
Yeah.
Well, if you do a building committee, I probably will be leaving.
Well, that's yeah.
But
next.
You look at the foot of the cross. What did Jesus establish? He established a community.
Yeah.
To take care of one another.
So the best we can do is a community church.
Promote itself. Or secure its own future.
Because establishing that foundation and putting up those walls and doctrine and having all of that stuff is just racing to the world's finish line of security versus being there fluidly within the community to find yourself secure in any position that you need. So if you're having church out at Blind Flu every week because that's the only place that is provided at the time, you're happy to go there if the community is there.
But that was so perfect.
Yeah, what did Paul... You know, Paul wrote love covers a... Is it Paul or John? Love covers a multitude of sins. Now, we may get a lot of things wrong, but if we take care of one another, so we're doing what God wants.
Covers up all those goats.
The goat hair with sheep.
And that's what's wrong with our punitive mentality is that we have such a hard time accepting that, you know, because Jerry's like, well, and Dennis, it can't work in this society. Well, it can't, because everybody's hung up on, what do we do if this guy's lazy? You know, he got poor, and I'm supposed to take care of him, but he got poor because he sat on his butt all day. And then the punitive thing comes in. Well, what are we going to do to him? You know, and so then it's like, well, I'm going to make him work really hard because I can't stand he sat around.
No.
You know, that's so true. Can we tolerate? Because I was in a church that this
no,
actually
can't
happened. I was in a church that this actually did happen. Is one of the families was a missionary daughter, very progressive family, and she married basically a bum. He wasn't a bad bum. He was a nice bum. But he's a nice person. But he's a
bum.
Just
sat on his bum.
That's his personality. That church accommodated that family, as far as I know, for 30 years. And they accepted the bum to be who he was. And he was a viable entity. I mean, there's nothing. He was who he was. And it's okay. And they built a house for him. They, you know, they...
Restorative justice is doing the right thing. It would include encouraging someone who, you know, maybe doesn't have a predisposition to working, to maybe teaching, exploring ways that they can contribute.
So here's just the devil's advocate then. So that was a pretty mild one to forgive. You see, society can deal with the guy that doesn't want to do much. What do we do with the guy that literally wants to hurt you? You know, then the punitive system really becomes...
Jesus allowed him to kill him.
Then you get scared. Mm-hmm. Then it's back to what do we do
about this? The system was
this.
More important than his life.
So you come back to, we have people that want to cut your heart. They don't necessarily want to kill you. They want to kill you mentally. They want to hurt your heart. What do you do with those people?
Faith.
What do you do with the ones that are willing to actually come right in and destroy everyone so that they can continue doing what they want to do rather than what they think is right for everyone.
Jesus did not spend much of his time with people who wanted to hurt him.
He walked away.
He walked away.
Well, that's why I'm asking, because it's
he
so
didn't
hard.
Try to hurt them. He didn't retaliate, but he did not.
But in our society, we're put in positions where our family will tell us you can't walk away from your family. And that is one where I have the hardest time with it, because I come from a situation where multitudes of the family walked away from each other for more than one reason or another.
But that's okay.
But when you look at some of the reasons why they do it, or why you have to do it, you wonder if you're doing the right thing or not. And how much effort are you supposed to put into that person? Well, mostly yes, like my brother, because here's a person that you... that okay, yeah. He's lazy and you want to take care of him,
there,
so you take care of him, but what do you do?
There's no one right answer, because every case is different.
Right, and then you get to a point where you're saying, okay, this, and I think that's why everybody goes to this punitive thing, or goes to this the logistic part of things.
Laws make it easy.
Yes.
Policies make things real easy, because you don't have to think anymore.
You don't have to justify it anymore. You don't have to worry. You don't have to wonder or care.
And that's why Christianity should be hard. Because Christianity does not rely on fixed, written, codified laws and policies.
And then there's even the scary part where, okay, so, you know, brother's a good one, because here you try to take care of your brother that's done this, but say you can't, so you have to let that one go, but then you have his family. You try to take care of the family, and that incurs even more wrath from that person that you're trying to take care of their family for, because you know they're not going to. So you're still stuck.
One thing
with
that I
person,
found from that
you
church
can't walk away from them.
And I did not know this existed when I was a kid, but when I look back, I realized what was going on. What you're talking about right now is an individual, and you're taking on the individual responsibility. And that's not what the church did at all. The church had some very wealthy people, but it was not outwardly apparent. The person who lived in a duplex in a very modest little house that did all the stuff, that did all the pathfinders and all that, no, those kids didn't have a side's food. She was the most wealthy person in the church. But the point was, the church solved the problem. They got into their board meetings, they solved the problem, and they fixed that family up. Regarding your brother and your brother's family, it's not your problem, it's the church's problem. And you need to bring it to the church, and the church will deal with it, not the individual.
Huh. Wait,
ideal.
Yeah.
Like the socioeconomic, I mean, we're talking a bigger picture.
We are. We tend to want to, in our modernist Western mindset that's heavily influenced by Americanism, we want to fix everything ourselves without bothering people around us.
Okay.
That's not the church. What Jesus said is the church, we are supposed to bear one another's burdens. We're supposed to help one another. We're supposed to share. You know, even if we are not able to contribute directly, by sharing, we are able to. When one person shares, that helps. You know, it unloads. It reduces the stress level. Going back to stress at the very beginning.
I think a good Bible working community, and if you want to call it church board, if you just want to talk to the community, it's the community that answers problems, not the individual.
That's a good one.
Anyway, we are. Time here.